WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's the job of my guest, Tom Friedman, to try to make sense of some of the more confusing things happening around the world. Tom Friedman is the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. He won Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting as the Times bureau chief in Beirut and Jerusalem, and he won a National Book Award in 1988 for his book From Beirut to Jerusalem. Friedman's new book is called The Lexus and the Olive Tree. It looks at the globalization of economics, politics, and culture, how microchips, satellites, fiber optics, and the internet are changing everything, including business, hamburgers, and war. He started examining the new era of globalization through his column, which focuses on the intersection between foreign policy and international finance. That doesn't necessarily sound like the sexiest subject to write about. I asked Tom Friedman how he realized it would be as exciting as it turned out to be.
You know, I always say to people, I have the best job in the world. I get to be a tourist with an attitude. And I get to go around the world and see whatever I want. There's only one downside with this job. You have to have attitudes twice a week, actually, every Tuesday and Friday. And the question was really kind of, what attitudes? And to answer that question, I really had to answer a prior question. What is kind of the super story out there in the world today? What is the framework which is really influencing everyone's behavior? And as I traveled around the world, and I started to connect the dots between what was going on, what I was finding in Thailand and what I was finding in China, what I discovered, Terry, was the following, that we've been talking for the last 10 years about the post-Cold War world. We've been describing the world by what it isn't because we didn't know what it was, and so we just called it the post-Cold War world. Well, this book is an argument for what it is, and the argument is that globalization is not a trend, it's not a phenomena, it's not an economic fad. It is the international system that has replaced the Cold War system. And like the Cold War system, it affects everything. It affects many things, let's say, both domestically and in the foreign relations of every country. The Cold War system was characterized by a single word, division. And all your threats and opportunities in this Cold War system really grew out of who you were divided from. And it was symbolized by a single word, the wall. The globalization system is characterized by a single word, integration, and all the threats and opportunities in this system flow from who you're connected to, and it's symbolized by a single word, the web. So we've gone from a world, as I discovered traveling around, where in the Cold War system we reached for the hotline, which kind of symbolized that we were all divided, but two people were in charge, the U.S. and the USSR, to a system in which we reach for the internet, where we're all connected and nobody's in charge.
You've come up with an expression, the golden straitjacket, and you call this garment the defining political economic garment of the globalization era. Describe what you mean by that.
Well, one of the themes of this book is that when your country joins the global economy, it's the equivalent of taking your country public. It's really like turning your country into a public company with the shareholders often abroad. I mean, I tell a story in the book just by way of example where I was interviewing the Thai prime minister and I began half serious, half joking, saying, Mr. Prime Minister, I have a confession to make. I helped oust your predecessor and I didn't even know his name. I was home in my basement, saw what happened to the collapsing Thai currency, called my broker, told him to get me out of East Asian emerging markets, could have shorted you over the internet, decided to get my broker's advice. It's $1, one vote, Mr. Prime Minister. How does it feel to have Tom Friedman as a constituent? Well, he laughed, but he knew what I meant. He had taken his country public. Now, when you do that, what you do is put on what I call the golden straitjacket. Now, the golden straitjacket embodies all the rules, all the economic rules of this system, rules about deficit to GDP ratios and, you know, inflation rates and deregulating your economy and opening it to foreign trade. Two things happen when your country puts on the golden straitjacket. And incidentally, Margaret Thatcher was the original seamstress of the golden straitjacket. Two things happen when your country puts it on. One is that your economy grows from more privatization, deregulation, foreign trade, and foreign investment. and your politics shrinks. Your economy grows, and your political choices shrink to Pepsi or Coke, to mere nuances. I mean, what was the difference between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole at the end of the day? Clinton wanted to add some padding in the shoulder, and, you know, Dole was ready to loosen the middle a little bit. John Major and Tony Blair in the British election, Paddy Ashdown, the third-party leader in Britain, had it exactly right. He looked at Blair and Major and said, synchronized swimming. Well, I see synchronized swimming in every country that, alas, has had to put on the golden straitjacket. There's only one good thing about the golden straitjacket. It does produce gold.
How?
By expanding your economy, encouraging technology to come in, encouraging competition, encouraging more open trade.
Give us a little more sense about what you mean by the global economy. I mean, okay, everybody's an investor now, and people are investing in other countries' economies. We're seeing economies grow and then collapse. But it's not like it's an organized system that actually has rules yet. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like a projection onto something.
Absolutely. Well, what happened here is that when the walls got blown away, you know, with the end of the Cold War system, several things happened. One is, as you just said, the golden straitjacket got created. Another important thing that got happened was a new energy source in the world, and that's what I call in the book the electronic herd. The electronic herd are all these investors from, you know, you and your neighbor at home on your E-Trade website from your computer to Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns and Fuji Bank. And it is a huge herd of global investors today. And they really have the money to grow. Governments, you know, are all running balanced budgets, basically. They don't have the money to throw around that they did in the past for these kind of growth projects. So to thrive in this new world, you really got to plug into that electronic herd.
You know, you point out that the global economy is having a conflicting impact on democratization, and you know, you're talking about the role of investors. You say it's possible that investors one day demand the rule of law in a country before investing in it, and then the next day, the investors stomp out of town like King Kong, squashing everybody in its path. Talk a little bit about, you know, this idea of investors having this conflicting impact on democratization.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because, you know, one of the things that anyone who reads this book will quickly see, I'm very ambivalent about this system. I my view basically is, look, I didn't start it. I can't stop it. I just want to try to get the best out of it and cushion the worst. The penultimate chapter of the book is called If You'd Like to Speak to a Human Being, Press 1. And really, it's in that chapter where I try to explain that one of the things about this system is that it's everything and its opposite. It can be incredibly democratizing and incredibly authoritarian, because suddenly you have this herd out there that is voting or influencing, you know, your country's economic policies at a minimum, if not their own politics, okay, but is not really governed in any way by the rules and limitations and restrictions of your own politics. So the system can be, as I say, incredibly democratizing and also incredibly authoritarian. It can be incredibly particularizing. Everyone has their own website now, and it can be incredibly homogenizing. It can be incredibly empowering and incredibly disempowering. And that's why I end that chapter with a cartoon from The New Yorker where these two Hell's Angels are on a motorcycle and they're talking. One basically says to the other, say, how was your day? And the other one says, well, advancing issues led declines. And for me, about the most you can say about this system, Terry, is that the most you can hope for is that if we can keep advancing issues leading declines for more people in more countries on more days, we're doing God's work. But it's always going to be a tension there, because there are some really ugly, brutalizing, authoritarian aspects of this system as well.
My guest is New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, and his new book is called The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. Some people end up being really losers, or at least losers in the short term, in the new global economy, and you point out that many of the losers are from the middle and the working classes, in the sense that poor people were already poor, and they might end up staying poor, but they're in the same position as they were before, whereas a lot of working and middle-class people end up losing jobs in the new economy, and they're really angry about it. What are your thoughts about the impact of the global economy on those people and their reaction to it?
Well, I went to Brazil last summer with Conservation International, and they took me to visit a site in the Atlantic rainforest where Conservation International, in alliance with a group of Brazilian environmentalists, had basically put out of business, much of a village that had been dependent on logging of the Atlantic rainforest, which is now basically only about 5% is left. And to help these people, Conservation International and the local villagers had set up a tourist project there, and there's a hotel that's gone in to help provide alternative jobs. Well, the mayor of this village, the village is called Una, took us on a tour of this new walkway through the Atlantic rainforest. And he was a wonderful man, a sort of Brazilian lumberjack. His great-grandfather had been a logger. His grandfather had been a logger. He had been a logger. And in effect, Conservation International put his family out of business. And he understood that logging probably wasn't going to be sustainable. They were running out of trees. But he wasn't real keen on this in any event. Well, we went on the tour, and at the end of the tour, I interviewed him in the middle of the rainforest for a half hour. And at the end of the interview, I was packing up my little ThinkPad, and he said, can I ask you a question? We were speaking through a Portuguese translator. I said, sure, please, go ahead. He said, do I have any future? Ooh, Jesus. It really brought tears to my eyes practically. I mean, I'd never been asked a question like that by anyone. Do I have any future? And I knew what was on his mind. What he was saying was, look, my dad made his living from the logs, and my kids and my grandkids, maybe they're going to be on the web, but I'm 46 years old. What about me? And I gave him some answer about needing to, educate his kids in the village and whatnot, and I mean, whatever I could think of off the top of my head. When he thanked me and he got up to leave, and when he left, I asked the translator, when he got to the car, if he would ask the mayor what he thought of my answer. And the translator came back after a few minutes and said basically something the mayor had said earlier. He wanted to reinforce that when he gets to his office every day, there are 200 people there waiting for him, asking for jobs, food, or housing. And if he can't provide them the jobs, food, and housing, they're going to eat the rainforest, and they're not going to care.
So you think there needs to be some kind of safety net and really good retraining program to help people who have been displaced by the changes in the economy?
My politics is very simple, Terry. I am a radical globalizer and I think a radical social democrat, all right? I believe that you dare not be a globalizer today. You dare not be an advocate of free trade and, integration and open markets, etc., without being a social democrat, without being ready to see your tax dollars spent on those programs that can democratize globalization and bring the have-nots, no-nots, and left-behinds into this system so they can benefit from it. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to maintain the political openness in your society to keep this system alive. At the same time, I do believe you dare not be a social democrat without being a globalizer, because otherwise you're not going to be able to generate the incomes you need and the advances in technology you need in order to have the incomes to redistribute. And so that's really my own politics. I call myself in the book an integrationist social safety netter.
My guest is New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman, author of the new book The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, whose new book is called The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. Do you think your view on the war in Yugoslavia is colored by your thoughts on the global economy? Do you think that your thinking on the global economy has entered your analysis of the war?
Well, only in this sense. I mean, why is the book called The Lexus and the Olive Tree? The title comes from I visited Japan in 1992, and I went to the Lexus factory, which at that time was the cutting-edge car factory in the world. And I was just blown away. They built the Lexus with 66 human beings and 310 robots. I was riding back to Tokyo on the bullet train, eating my sushi bento box dinner and reading that day's International Herald Tribune. And there was a story on page 3 of that Herald Tribune about how then State Department spokeswoman had issued a statement about a UN resolution on Palestine, 1948 resolution, and both the Arabs and Israelis were up in arms, Terry. And I sort of, the thought for this book really hit me then. I thought, you know, here are these Japanese whose factory I've just visited, whose bullet train I'm now riding, whose sushi I'm now eating, are building the greatest luxury car in the world with robots. And up here on page three are the Arabs and Israelis, whom I lived with for so long, whom I love so dearly, who are still fighting over who owns which olive tree. And isn't that the post-Cold War world, that half of us are struggling to, you know, for modernization, development, integration, to be part of this new system, and half of us are still fighting over who owns which olive tree? And olive trees are important. They're what anchor us in the world. They provide us the warmth of community and the vision of identity. And a tree without roots will never be stable, but a tree that is only roots will never grow into the world, bear fruit, and provide shade. What I see as the drama of this system we're now in is the what is old, the olive tree, that quest for identity, community, olive trees that will anchor us, bumping up against this new system of globalization. I look at Kosovo in that context. To me, Kosovo is the story of what happens when these olive tree passions run riot in a place. They will run riot there. They will run riot in other places as well. And all I can tell you is that in this system, Terry, the people who want to pursue the olive tree wars to this nth degree, to this barbaric degree, are going to pay a huge price in this system. See, in the old Cold War system, the United States or the Soviet Union would come in and replenish your army. They'd buy your, you know, junky exports or whatever. Because in the old system, all they cared about was if you were on their side, you know, on the chessboard. But in this new system, there is no Soviet Union anymore. There's no automatically their guys, so there's no automatically our guys. Governments aren't going to come in and you know, fund your little war anymore. So as a result, the people who have money in this new system, that electronic herd, not only are they not going to fund your little war, they're going to punish you for your little war.
Because now, your war is creating financial instability, and that's not good for investors and business.
Exactly. And they're just going to say, hey, we don't want to be a part of this, so we're just going to go away. Does that mean people aren't going to have wars? No. Some people, for these very powerful issues of identity and community, are going to kind of burst right through the restraints of the system. But the price they're going to pay in Serbia, Terry, is going to be so much greater than in that old system, because they're going to fall behind farther and faster than ever before.
Of course, a lot of political leaders care more about personal power,
absolutely,
I think, than they do about anything else, the lives of the people in their country. They care more about personal power than the economy. I mean, personal power is just everything.
And that's why I say in the book, you know, that there's a real, the tension in this system, the drama, as it were, are these issues of politics, culture, and identity bumping up against the new system? And the only claim I make in the book is that if in the old system, the Cold War system, people thought twice about going to war, in this system, they'll think three times.
Why?
Because I think the costs are so much greater to your community. And, you know, look at Russia today, Terry. You know, in the first week of this war in Kosovo, the Russians came out and said, we're not going to stand for this. NATO shouldn't be allowed to do it. We're not going to do it. Primakov issued all these statements, and he just slammed the table. We will not stand for this. The very next day, Primakov said, but the IMF is still going to come here and give us the money we need, don't they? Because you said, yeah, political leaders, sometimes these wars work for them, but a lot of times they don't. And Primakov also knows that what's fatal for him today is if Russia cannot get the growth it needs, that maybe someone else will be able to take advantage of it, but he is the steward of Russia today, will not. And so what I see when I look at Russia today is a country really struggling. There's a real kind of olive tree tug there to be involved in this conflict in some way. And there's a huge Lexus tug working the other way. I make no predictions of which will come out, but there's a real tension there.
Tom Friedman is my guest. He's a New York Times columnist and author of the new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. You covered the Middle East for a long time. You were a diplomatic correspondent for a while for the New York Times. What do you think of negotiating with Milosevic. I think that's one of the big controversies now, is whether you can negotiate with somebody who has broken so many promises in the past.
Well, you know, Boris Yeltsin, on a slow day in Chechnya, Terry, probably killed more people, I dare say, than have been killed in Kosovo so far. I believe in focusing on what my objectives are. My objectives are the return of these refugees to their home, as many as possible, if not all, to their homes, and the implementation and the insertion into Kosovo of an international peacekeeping force that can protect these people so they can live their lives under self-rule. Those are my objectives. If I have to negotiate with Milosevic to do that, then I will do that, and I will leave for the Serb people to come out of their shelters after this war is over, to look around at the damage that has been done, and to conclude whether Milosevic is the man to lead them in the future. I do it repugnantly. You know, when supping with the devil, I would do it with a long spoon, but if I can achieve my objectives, I would do it. I think you have to keep your eye on the prize here.
Tom Friedman is the New York Times foreign affairs columnist and author of the new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Friedman, the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and former bureau chief in Beirut and Jerusalem. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting and a National Book Award for his book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. His new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, is about the new era of globalization. Friedman says globalization has replaced the Cold War as the system you need to comprehend to understand how the world works and where the U.S. fits in. How do you see the United States' role in the world now as compared to during the Cold War?
I think we have as big a role, only more so, because we are the biggest beneficiaries of this system. We are the people benefiting most from all this global integration, most from all these, you know, booming financial.
Because it's our products that are being sold around the world, and our investors that are making a lot of money.
Are thriving, and all you have to do is look at our markets today.
Our Disneyland.
Exactly. Everyone wants, we are, as I say in the book, we're the Michael Jordan of geopolitics. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to be like Mike, and sure, they complain that the referees always gave Mike a break, and they always like to beat Mike, you know. But I'll tell you, Michael Jordan had one real weakness. He was nothing without the rest of the NBA. He was nothing without the other 29 teams. And we're nothing without the rest of the world. And we have a responsibility to help maintain this league, okay? And we have a responsibility to do it by maintaining, you know, all this globalization, all these this webbing of the world, all these networks, all this integration. It's not just happening. It's happening within a power structure. It's happening within a world stabilized by a benign superpower called the United States of America, with something called the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Marine Corps, and the U.S. Air Force. And, you know, there's no McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas that makes the F-15. And there's no hidden hand without the hidden fist. And we have got to be that hidden fist for this system. And if it means we pay a disproportionate share, so be it, because we are earning a radically disproportionate benefit.
So if you think that America's new role is, or a continuation of its old role, is to be the fist that keeps the system going and punishes people who are in some ways destroying the system, I'm wondering if you think the ways of fighting are different. I mean, right now we've been bombing Iraq and we've been bombing Serbia, and there are these strange wars that, like this thing in Iraq has gone on, off and on, for years, and yet the ruler of the country is still in place. I mean, what's changed is this like low-level war that keeps going on, and sometimes it's in the headlines and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, I mean, in this system, it's like America today is in the paradoxical situation here where we're kind of responsible for everything, but no one wants to die for anything. And that's why cruise missiles are in, but green berets are out. You know, babysitting is in, you know, from the UN, but, you know, direct intervention is out. And I partly, you know, have sympathy with that, and I partly chafe against it. My own position on Kosovo has been, you know, we needed to do something there for both humanitarian reasons and strategic reasons. You cannot be a NATO member. United States cannot be a European power as we are for good and historic reasons and modern reasons, and then be utterly indifferent to what is going on there. But my own feeling is that whether by accident or design, the president has probably stumbled into the least bad strategy. There is no good option there, but he's probably stumbled into the least bad strategy for the moment, which is try to reverse the bad thing happening in Kosovo with air power in hopes of bringing about a negotiated settlement that can get the Kosovo Albanians home under some kind of international protection. I don't know that air power is going to work. I also don't know that it's not going to work. I simply don't buy the argument that it can't work in this situation. I think it's far too early to render that judgment. But I think the key here is to try to achieve our humanitarian objective, get the refugees home, and our strategic objective, which is basically putting them under some kind of international protection, and do it, Terry, without turning this part of the world into an all-consuming, sucking chest wound that then undermines our ability and our moral responsibility to maintain and stabilize a whole lot of other areas of the world.
You know, your book really talks a lot about how no matter where anybody lives now, they have access. If they have any money and if they have wires, they have access to the internet, to CNN and Sky News, and it's just really changed the way people see the world and their place in it. One of the things that interests me now about what's happening in Serbia is that, you know, people have access to CNN and they're watching Sky News, which is the European equivalent of CNN. And yet many of the people in Serbia seem to be believing what Milosevic is telling them about the war. And they think that the reporters on CNN and Sky News are lying with propaganda. And a lot of people, I think, truly believe that Albanians in Kosovo are fleeing because of the NATO bombing, not because of systematized ethnic cleansing. And I'm wondering what you think about that, you know, how people could live in a country and like, disbelieve all this international information that they have access to now and believe a propagandistic dictator instead.
I think, you know, there are several answers I would give you. You know, that yes, a lot of the information coming in over the internet or over satellite TV into Kosovo, it's coming in. What portion of the population it was reaching at its height and what portion it's even reaching now that so many of the communication lines are down, I don't know. But I think the thing to keep in mind, Terry, is that most of that was probably in English or in European languages. There is no competing with kind of your local Serbo-Croatian, you know, media in terms of communicating with a mass base of people. And the media that the native language media in Serbia, from everything I understand, is largely dominated by Milosevic and his view of the world. So it's still very hard to compete with that. The other thing is there's nothing like being bombed, you know, by someone to really engender some kind of local solidarity. And I think that's working against us as well. I know NATO's tried to drop leaflets and whatnot explaining what they're doing. But I think it's going to be a while before, you know, the Serbs really fully understand what's being done in Kosovo. It's going to be a while before we all fully understand what's being done in Kosovo. And I think we do have to keep in mind, because, you know, one side is bad here, doesn't mean the other side was good. The KLA were responsible, the Kosovo Liberation Army were also responsible for the killing of Serb police. They were also up to a lot of very bad things. Their ranks are filled with, you know, people including Islamic fundamentalists and hardline communists. So, you know, it's I often view these conflicts as between, you know, two bad guys with a lot of innocent civilians in between. And I'm not sure, you know, how much of that we have here, too.
You know, as you point out in your book, instead of describing this as like the post-Cold War world, we can describe this as the era of globalization. And globalization has a system that we're starting to understand, and you've come up with a lot of principles for it. NATO grew out of the Cold War era. And the purpose of NATO really was to protect Europe against the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union isn't the threat that it was. The Cold War is over. What's the role of NATO, do you think, in this new era, in this globalization era?
Well, I think NATO is going to replace, in some ways, the United Nations, at least in a certain part of the world, as the key police force. I don't object to that. I think when you can get 19 democracies working together to support common humanitarian and strategic objectives, that is a good and worthy task. But I think you have to use it sparingly, and you have to use it carefully. I happen to believe that this project of trying to curb Milosevic in the Balkans was a worthy and legitimate project for NATO. I don't object to that. I don't object to that, Terry.
Do you really see NATO as, in a way, taking on some of the responsibilities of the United Nations? I mean, it's not the United Nations. It's not neutral. It has self-interest to protect.
Well, as I said, it's in a certain part of the world. To me, the importance of NATO, and let's go back to kind of the broader view of the system, is that if we as the United States have the biggest interest in maintaining the system and the biggest resources for maintaining it and the biggest responsibilities for maintaining it, we can't be everywhere maintaining it all the time. We have to find ways to leverage our power. And NATO is one way to do that, where in a solution in Kosovo, we contribute 4,000 troops, the Europeans contribute 25,000. The UN, Terry, is another way of doing that. I'm a UN fan. I believe the World Bank is another way of doing that. We need to find ways to leverage our power where we contribute something and others contribute something to magnify our influence, stabilize this system as much as we can, keep it together. Because we are Michael Jordan of this system. We are the biggest beneficiaries, but we cannot live without the other 29 teams.
My guest is Tom Friedman, the New York Times foreign affairs columnist and author of the new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. His new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, is about the global economy. You know, in some ways, we went right from impeachment into bombing Serbia. I mean, that was pretty abrupt. And I'm wondering if you think that the president's position now is being compromised at all by the taint of the impeachment.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, Terry, I've been thinking about this a lot, and there's something about maybe the Dow at 10,000, this sort of comfortable, no threat, no fundamental threat to the United States world we now live in, that in my mind explains both this impeachment episode and in some ways Kosovo, in some ways for both. I don't want to exaggerate this, but, you know, we're so fat, dumb, and happy now that we kind of looked at impeachment as entertainment. I mean, it really was. I mean, Bill Clinton kept us entertained. What the heck? Let's impeach the president. That'll really be interesting. And the sort of ease with which people talk about sending ground troops into Kosovo and making a sort of open-ended commitment to probably the most volatile, unstable corner of the world is also kind of part of this sense of why not? You know, if our economy was not in the shape that's it's in now, if our country wasn't as strong as it is now, I'm not sure people would be tossing, you know, these things off as blithely as they do. And I feel real strongly about that. That, you know, I have a chapter in the book called Rational Exuberance. It is about why, you know, the United States is doing so well now. But I'll end that chapter with a quote from Deputy Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who I think puts it quite well. He says, there's only one thing we have to fear, and that's the lack of fear itself.
What do you mean by that? What did he mean by that?
He meant that thinking, you know, that you've found the secret, okay, and that this system of the Dow at 10,000 and our economic superiority and our military superiority, it's not guaranteed forever. If you don't work on it every day, and if you don't work on the context for our strengths every day, taking care of the people who don't benefit, keeping the bad guys back, but also understanding your limits, all right, you may find yourself on the other side of the system.
For a long time, you've had a great seat for observing what's happening in the world as a Middle East correspondent, diplomatic correspondent, now foreign affairs columnist, But in between someplace there, you covered the White House. I think it was...
For my sins.
Yeah.
For my sins, Terry. They put me at the White House for a year.
Will you describe your coverage, your position as White House correspondent as mercifully brief?
Right.
And then you write in parentheses, none dare call it journalism.
Right.
What's your beef with being a White House correspondent? What made that such an unsavory position for you?
Well, I would say, it is such a cross between babysitting and stenography. You're trapped in this building, basically, with a, you're kind of in a pen down there at the basement of the White House. Access to officials is restricted or limited. And you're basically a ball and chain around the president's ankle, going wherever he goes, subject most of the time to his agenda. And I hated it. I'm a foreign correspondent. I always said, coming from Beirut to the, covering the, going from covering the Middle East to covering the State Department is like going from, covering a street to covering a hall. It's going from covering a drama unfolding before your eyes to covering a policy that's invisible. It's hard to say, geez, I met the policy outside the C Street entrance of the State Department today. I saw the policy wounded, on the sidewalk of the State Department today. It's terrible. It's terrible because I have a fundamental rule about journalism. I have young people often, write me and say, I want to be a journalist. What do I have to do? And I have a very simple answer. Hey, it's great to know English. It's great to know how to type 80 words a minute. It's great to know economics. But let me tell you, there's really just one skill you need, to be a good journalist. And if you got it, you'll be fine. If you don't have it, you'll never be fine. You have to like people. You have to enjoy hearing their stories, the music of their lives, the crazy things they say and do. Because if you don't enjoy the music and you can't hear the music, you're never going to be able to play the music. And I like people. I like hearing the crazy, wild, dangerous, sometimes frightening things they do, sometimes really exciting things they do. I like being out there. I don't like covering a policy.
Were there other reasons why you didn't like covering the White House, in addition to the fact that it's in part covering policy and getting, press releases and attending briefings?
Well, I would say, there's one incident that always struck in my mind. I did, as I say, cover the first year of the Clinton White House, and it was really Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. Everything happened there, from Lonnie Guinier to the travel office affair, And I remember the day they issued the internal White House report about the firing of all those travel office employees. And Mac McClarty, who was then White House Chief of Staff, issued the report. And there came an issue in the report about something that David Watkins said, who was the guy who was supervising the office. And the report struck me as kind of whitewashing what David Watkins had to say. And I raised my hand to Mac and I said, Mac, where I come from in Minnesota, we call that lying. And kind of, fobbed it off or dodged the bullet, whatever. I went back to my office and a senior White House official called me. My phone, we had a message on there as soon as I got back. I called him back and he said, I just want you to know that I would not dispute your characterization in that briefing. And it just always struck me, it's all off the record and I can't quote it, but you're just in the middle of this muck and of policy and infighting and who's up and who's down. I don't care who's up and who's down, okay? I really am interested in the world. I'm interested in people. And I was totally miscast as a White House correspondent. I was awful, okay? I will confess that in the here and now. I couldn't wait to get out. There was only one good side of it. I was really glad to see the world from the perspective of the White House and the presidency, because it does look different. Both Washington looks different, and it looks different in terms of the forces and issues you have to balance.
Well, Tom Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Tom Friedman is the New York Times foreign affairs columnist and author of the new book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. This is Fresh Air.